Hello, welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It's Thursday, February 25, and the front page headline for the Gazette today, GOP lawmakers cut early absentee voting. This story is by Aaron Murphy. A sweeping proposal to limit early and absentee voting in Iowa, among myriad other changes in how elections are conducted here, is on its way to Governor Kim Reynolds after gaining final approval Wednesday by Republican lawmakers. The proposal sped through the legislative process in just 8 days and with only GOP support. Democrats lambasted the bill as voter suppression, a solution in search of a problem. Iowa has clean, fair elections. This bill is based on lies and makes it harder for Iowans to vote. We should be making it easier for Iowans to vote. Representative Sharon Steckman, Democrat from Mason City, said during the debate that lasted more than 5 hours, most of which featured Democrats speaking against the bill. Republicans say the wide-ranging legislation will make Iowa's elections more secure and consistent statewide, and will reduce campaigns' contacts with voters. It is going to remain really easy to vote after this legislation is signed into law, Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican from Wilton, said during the Iowa House debate. This bill does not suppress one single vote. It passed the Iowa House on a 57-37 party line vote. The Republican governor has not said whether she will sign the bill into law, but did say she is open to reducing the state's early voting period. Reynolds is scheduled to hold a news conference today. Among many other things, the bill would reduce Iowa's early voting period, constrain early voting programs like satellite voting locations and drop boxes, require absentee ballots to be received by Election Day even if they are postmarked in time, close the polls on Election Day an hour earlier, and punish county election officials who violate state election laws with fines and possibly prison time. The proposed changes come after a record-setting turnout last November in Iowa, which was boosted by early and absentee voting in the midst of the pandemic. In that general election, Iowa set state records for the most votes cast overall, more than 1.7 million, and the most early votes cast, more than 1 million. Iowa's turnout rate of 76% was among the highest in the country, and the election was secure. No cases of election fraud were reported. The proposed legislation would limit or ban many of the programs that contributed to that record turnout. While both major political parties over the past decade have increased their use of early voting, data shows historically more Democrats than Republicans vote early. I am weary of this bill. I am frustrated by this bill, and I am angry at this bill, Representative Jennifer Confrust, Democrat, Windsor Heights, said. Senator Jim Carlin, a Sioux City Republican who has announced his candidacy for the U.S. Senate, said the legislation also is needed to ensure voters' confidence in elections, and repeated the widely debunked claim that widespread fraud led to Democratic President Joe Biden's 2020 victory. During a public hearing on Senate File 413 held Monday, 19 Iowans spoke in opposition to the proposal, and 9 spoke in favor. In online comments on the legislative website, opposition was even more lopsided. Roughly 30 wrote comments in support of the bill, versus more than 1,200 wrote in opposition. The Senate approved the bill Tuesday on a 30-11 party line vote. If Reynolds approves, the legislation could be signed into law by this weekend, just more than a week after it was first made public. Also on the front page, here's an accompanying article stating, "Here is what's in the election bill." Measures overhauling elections in Iowa are rapidly moving in the State House. Here are some of the major provisions of the House File 590, Senate File 413. Cuts early voting, shortens the early voting period to 20 days from 29, 3 years after Republicans reduced the time period from 40 days. Limits absentees. Auditors would not be allowed to mail an absentee ballot request form unless the voter asked for it. Voters now may request an absentee ballot up to 120 days before an election. That would be cut to 70 days. But auditors could not mail that absentee ballot to a voter until 20 days, not the current 29, before an election, with few exceptions. Most mail ballots would have to be received by county election officials by the time polls close on election day. Currently, they are counted if they are postmarked in time but arrive a few days late. The bill allows but does not require counties to have one box for voters to drop off absentee ballots. It cuts poll hours. While polls for city and school elections already close at 8 p.m., polls now stay open until 9 for general elections. The bill would close them at 8 p.m. also. And limit satellites. An auditor could not provide a satellite voting location unless asked. Warns auditors. Elected auditors who willingly neglect complying with some of the requirements could be charged with a Class D felony, punishable by up to 5 years in prison, and a fine up to $10,245. Also on the front page today, UI still bullish on North Liberty Hospital. This story is by Vanessa Miller. Last week's denial from the state panel, not unexpected. 1 week after a state council narrowly denied a University of Iowa healthcare application to build a $230 million hospital in North Liberty, UI Vice President for Medical Affairs Brooks Jackson said Wednesday the setback wasn't surprising, and he expects the project will materialize eventually. The outcome, while disappointing, is not unexpected, he told the Board of Regents. Those of you who may be familiar with the Iowa Certificate of Need process know that it is not uncommon for a project of this significance to require more than one hearing before receiving approval. Despite fervent opposition from many regional community hospitals and healthcare providers to the proposed 300,000-square-foot UIHC expansion on 60 acres at Highway 965 and Forever Green Road, Jackson described the planned facility as a vital extension of our academic medical center in a community center that is centered on the patient. UIHC patients, unlike those at community hospitals, are complex with multiple comorbidities commonly. And this allows us to provide that service not only on this campus but out there as the need continues to grow year after year. This will help us decompress our main campus and open capacity for clinical services for those complex patients that need to remain on campus. Speaking confidently about the future of the proposed four-story hospital, Jackson told the Regents it will add up to 36 UIHC inpatient rooms, up to 16 operating rooms, an emergency department, and advanced ancillary services like imaging, pharmacy, and laboratories. But the State Health Facilities Council last week denied a certificate for the UIHC project. Its five members heard nearly 7 hours of testimony from supporters and also opponents, like Mercy Iowa City, Mercy Cedar Rapids, and Unity Point Health. This project, in my view, is completely unnecessary, Mercy Iowa City Emergency Department Medical Director Peter Perraud said in the hearing. It's bad for our physician group, bad for the community hospitals that we serve, and bad for the patients in our local community. This duplication of services could close the only community hospital in Iowa City, he warned. UIHC officials said they serve an entirely different and sicker set of patients, many of whom smaller hospitals transfer to UIHC. Those transfers, in part, have UIHC crammed but without space to expand on the main campus next to Kinnick Stadium, which is why it's considering land it owns in North Liberty. We see the coming tidal wave of an aging population with increasing comorbidities that will require the kind of complex care for which we are the only provider in Iowa, Jackson told Regents. We know that a second academic healthcare campus will address these growing health needs while simultaneously continuing to advance our research and education missions. UIHC administrators are waiting on a formal report from the State Council, which a representative told the Gazette could take weeks, to decide its next steps. But, Jackson said, we will continue to give 100% effort to make the case for this project, for the people of Iowa, just as we gave 100% effort to ensure we can meet the needs of our community to protect our state's hospital from collapse against the weight of a terrifying COVID surge. In addressing UI's healthcare's COVID-19 response and impact on its finances and operations, Jackson reported a sunnier picture than in November when UIHC had activated its pandemic surge plan, or in May when the campus projected it could take a $100 million hit. Instead, UIHC on Wednesday reported $1.1 billion in revenue to date this budget year, which ends June 30, above its $1 billion budget and last year's $988.5 million through the same period, with increased expenses for things like agency nurses, overtime, pharmaceuticals, and supply costs. UIHC's operating income still sits just under $52.9 million at $51.9. And as far as COVID-19 care goes, Jackson said the pandemic picture has improved significantly. We were able to deactivate our UIHC surge plan at the start of the new year, he said, and COVID-19 positivity rates in Johnson County and across the state have continued to trend downward. UIHC on Wednesday reported 14 COVID-19 inpatients, far fewer than the peak of over 100. More than 12,500 UIHC employees have received one dose of vaccine. More than 9,200 have received two. And by the end of Wednesday, he said, UIHC will have vaccinated about 6,500 patients and over 1,200 teachers in Johnson County. Jackson reported that on Wednesday alone, UIHC had vaccinated more than 2,000 people in Coralville, which is quite a feat. But even with those improvements, UI Hospitals and Clinics Chief Executive Officer Suresh Gunasekaran told Regents his campus still has the highest COVID-19 intensive care unit census in the state and the largest number of patients on ventilators. And none of them are from Johnson County, Gunasekaran said, pointing back to the different patient population UIHC serves and his argument for the need to expand. This is again a story of what the healthcare system needs us to do and what we need to do to have capacity and expertise to do it, which is ultimately to serve the whole state, he said. Moving now to the Iowa Today page, nutritional deficiency cited in geese deaths. This story is by Lee Hermiston. A nutritional deficiency following a long winter is thought to be causing dozens of geese to get sick or die on the Iowa River. More than 100 Canada geese and at least one mallard were found sick or dead near the Lowhead Dam by the Iowa River Power Restaurant on the Iowa River since first reported to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources last week, according to DNR State Wildlife Veterinarian Rachel Rudin. The sick geese were showing neurological symptoms and were taken to wildlife rehabilitators, Rudin said. DNR staff have been working to determine the cause of the sickness. At this time, on-site observations, gross finding on necropsy, and clinical signs are highly suggestive of a nutritional deficiency exacerbated by the severe winter weather we've been experiencing across the state, Rudin said in an email. Rudin said geese and ducks in the area were seen eating a shad, a fish with high levels of an enzyme known as thiaminase. High shad diets have been linked to thiamine or vitamin B1 deficiencies. That deficiency can lead to impaired brain function and death, Rudin said. We are waiting on additional diagnostics to confirm this diagnosis, but we anticipate the situation on the ground to improve as temperatures warm and waterfowl again have access to other food resources and foraging sites, Rudin said. And in another story, report of dead cattle leads to farmer's arrest. A Mount Vernon man was arrested Wednesday after authorities received a complaint about numerous dead cattle on his property. According to the Linn County Sheriff's Office, deputies responded to 81 Linn Ridge Road on February 11 after receiving reports of neglected cattle. Deputies found a number of dead cattle on the property. The Sheriff's Office said investigators determined the Angus cattle were being starved and living without proper shelter or care. Deputies attempted to work with owner Brian Griesel and a veterinarian to ensure the remaining animals were properly cared for, but during a follow-up visit, deputies found several more dead cattle. On February 15, the sheriff's office executed a search warrant at the property and rescued 18 head. Griesel, age 43, was arrested on a charge of livestock neglect resulting in death, a serious misdemeanor. The sheriff's office said Griesel was not living at the property where the cattle were located. And that story was by Kat Russell for the Gazette. In a story by Kat Russell, man stabbed in Cedar Rapids. A 19-year-old man was stabbed Monday night in Cedar Rapids. Officers were called just after 6 p.m. to a residence in the 500 block of McKinley Street Southeast, where they found a man with a stab wound to the chest, according to Cedar Rapids Police Department. He was rushed to a hospital. Also at the residence was James Eugene Sanfratello, 54, who was having difficulty breathing. Sanfratello was treated at a hospital and arrested on an active warrant after being released. Sanfratello is a suspect in the stabbing, police said, but no charges have been filed against him. Police said the circumstances of the stabbing are under investigation, but based on preliminary information, it is believed an argument between him and the 19-year-old escalated to the stabbing. The argument reportedly stemmed from Sanfratello entering the victim's apartment without permission. Sanfratello claimed he had entered the apartment to shut off a malfunctioning smoke alarm. However, police said he wasn't identified as the property owner or maintenance staff. Also on the Iowa Today page, this story by Kat Russell, again, domestic violence call preceded fatal stabbing in Cedar Rapids. Stabbing victim Katrina Brinson and Arnell States, the man suspected of stabbing her, were involved in a domestic disturbance the day before Brinson died. According to Cedar Rapids police, officers were called just after 5 a.m. February 19 to 1531 Washington Avenue Southeast for a domestic disturbance. Court documents show Brinson and States each listed that address as their residence in the past 12 months. Their Facebook profiles say the two were married. Police arrested Brinson, age 34, and States, age 39, on a domestic abuse charge. Police said Brinson accused States of strangling her for about 5 seconds, and investigators noted scratches on Brinson's neck. States said it was self-defense because Brinson was trying to scratch his face. Police said officers were unable to determine the primary aggressor or who initiated the altercation. Both individuals had injuries and were arguing, and both were taken to the Linn County Jail. They each were released after about 4 hours, the Linn County Sheriff's Office said, after the Linn County Attorney's Office declined to file charges. The following morning, just before 2 a.m. Saturday, officers were called to the Roadway Inn, 4011 16th Avenue Southwest, where they found Brinson and another woman had been stabbed. Brinson died at a hospital. The other woman, who authorities have not identified but said is 34 years old, was treated and released, according to the Iowa DCI. When police arrived at the motel, Brinson and the other woman directed an officer to a man, later identified as States, running from the building. The officer pursued the man and fired shots during the encounter. States died Tuesday at a hospital. Investigators have not yet identified the Cedar Rapids police officer involved in the shooting. The officer, whose name will be released after he is interviewed by DCI agents, remains on paid leave in accordance with department policies, investigators said. Also in the Iowa Today News, a city official's suit against newspaper goes to high court. This story is by Clark Kaufman for the Iowa Capital Dispatch. The Iowa Supreme Court will hear oral arguments today in an unusual case involving a former city administrator who argues that an Eastern Iowa newspaper successfully campaigned to run him out of town through unfavorable news articles and editorials. Craig Mallon, who served as Davenport's city administrator from August 2001 until June 2015, is suing the Quad City Times and two of its employees, reporters Bob Ickes and Brian Wellner. Mallon is not suing for libel, but for intentional interference with a contract, claiming that the newspaper's hostility toward him is what caused city aldermen to force him out. Initially, Mallon also sued the Times for defamation, but the newspaper won summary judgment on that count, which meant that when the case went to trial in 2019, the jury considered only Mallon's claim of intentional interference. In opening and closing arguments, Mallon's attorneys told jurors the Times article and editorials were intended not just to inform the public, but more importantly, to sway the city council. The Quad City Times is saying, if you guys don't get rid of Craig Mallon, we are going to help put you out of office. A jury decided in favor of the newspaper, which led to the appeal now before the Iowa Supreme Court. In briefs filed with the court, Mallon's attorneys now argue that after Mallon set up Davenport Today, a city-run online news outlet, the Times set out to run him out of town. They say the Times saw Davenport Today as a competing business, and soon after Mallon launched the site, the newspaper published a series of articles and columns that were almost uniformly critical of him. The paper, he said, also hammered him in an editorial that mentioned him 17 times and referred to him as a news executive. Many of the articles and editorials cited by Mallon were tied to a controversial decision by the city to pay for millions in road-related expenses associated with a casino development in Davenport. In his lawsuit, Mallon objected to the Times reporting he had made claims about certain aspects of the decision, rather than reporting on documents that supported those claims. Mallon claimed the paper falsely stated that he insisted he never agreed to a controversial element of the deal, arguing that he did not merely insist it. He also provided the newspapers with records that, in his views, proved that. Mallon cited a newspaper editorial that warned city aldermen they might face the wrath of voters due to Mallon's actions. That editorial, Mallon said, says in court filing, was intended to threaten the Davenport City Council into releasing him from his contract with the city. Until city officials signaled a desire to part ways with him, Mallon argues, they had never uttered a word of concern about his job performance. It was only as a result of the Times' cascade of actual malice. Mallon now argues at the Iowa Supreme Court that he had to restart his career in Seaside, California. In response, the newspaper argues that all of the objections Mallon raised about the Times' reporting, not once did he identify any substance in which he was misquoted, and he acknowledged the alderman criticized him in quotations to the paper. At the crux of the publication is the undisputed fact that the city council members felt misled by Mallon's actions and statements. Complicating matters is Mallon's assertion that some of the Times' opinion pieces weren't adequately labeled as such online, appearing on the webpage labeled as local news. The Times argues that Mallon's expert witness stated there could be confusion as to what is opinion and what is news, particularly among readers who saw only a headline. Mallon presented no evidence of actual reader confusion on that point, let alone that city aldermen were confused. In fact, the newspaper points out the only city alderman called to testify in the trial said the Times coverage of Mallon did not influence his judgment. The newspaper also notes the jury sided with the Times and found that its writings were protected by the First Amendment. Only after concluding the newspaper believed its writings were true, that it had not acted with reckless disregard for the truth, and that the subject matter of the articles and editorials was of public concern. Now moving to the Insight page for today, the Gazette's editorial, Bill Would Impede Early Voting. After one of the most successful elections in Iowa history, lawmakers are fast-tracking a bill that would make it harder for Iowans to vote. Companion bills quickly advancing through the Iowa House and Senate this week would erect unnecessary barriers to voting absentee by mail and early in-person voting, which are increasingly popular options. Last November, Iowans easily broke our election turnout record with nearly 1.7 million voters, including more than 1 million early voters. By all credible accounts, the system worked pretty well, but Republican leaders want to mess with success. Proponents seem to have two troubling motivations: a false belief that the 2020 election process was rigged against Donald Trump, and getting revenge against so-called rogue auditors from Blue Counties. Facing an election during a pandemic, auditors from Linn County and Johnson County last year sought to make voting easier and safer by bolstering access to mail-in ballots. They sent voters absentee ballot request forms with information already filled in, a move that defied the Secretary of State's guidance and drew legal action from the Trump campaign. Instead of clarifying the law to empower auditors to promote absentee voting, lawmakers are threatening penalties against election workers. It's just one item on a sizable list of new restrictions on voting proposed in the legislation. In an era of rigid partisan division, it is striking to see Republican county auditors speak out so forcefully against GOP-sponsored legislation. They come from some of the state's most reliable Republican strongholds, and they can clearly see the burdens this would impose on their constituents. Every auditor across this state works tirelessly to host elections Iowans can be proud of, and I think in 2020 we overwhelmingly proved that was the case, Adams County Auditor Rebecca Bissell said during a hearing this week. Legislative leaders' decision to cram a bill through in a matter of days deprives Iowans of the ability to understand a complicated piece of legislation. It's a big omnibus bill with many moving parts and lingering questions, a conglomeration of petty policymaking. During legislative proceedings, a few proponents have struggled to answer basic questions about the bill, underscoring how hastily it's being thrown together. Iowans like early voting. This legislation would make early voting harder. Again, that's the Gazette's own editorial. And one community letter today, lawmakers are just pretending to listen. I listened to a public hearing on House File 590 regarding significant changes to Iowa's voting laws. As I listened to people speaking in person in favor and against in the Iowa Capitol, I scrolled through and read the comments submitted online. The majority of those speaking in person and online do not support the changes proposed, which restrict voting access and local election control. Many spoke and wrote eloquently about how the proposed changes would negatively affect Iowa's older voters, rural voters, those with disabilities, and those whose jobs make it challenging to vote on election day. Some just plainly stated, "If it ain't broke, don't fix it," challenging the view of the state's Republican leadership that voter fraud is influencing election outcomes. No mention of the record-setting turnout in November, just more insinuation of the big lie. The real clincher was when GOP Representative Bobby Kaufman, the committee chairman, announced in closing that the vote for HF 590 would take place and be on the governor's desk by the end of the week. Well, I guess I just wasted my time as an engaged citizen who still believes our elected officials listen and take into account what Iowans want. It is abundantly clear that Republican leaders in Iowa are only interested in listening to the national Republicans who are now trying to pass laws that will restrict voting. And that was submitted by Carolyn Stevenson of Cedar Rapids. And our guest editorial, our 24-hour Dorman column today. Dorman writes, "Florida outfit backs lousy elections bill." Only three groups lobbied to pass lousy election bill that just tore like a bullet train through the Iowa legislature, fueled by fictional fraud. There's the Iowa Minuteman Civil Defense Corps, which supports right-wing legislation, and the Kirkwood Institute, led by Iowa Attorney Alan Ostergren, who helped the Republican National Committee and the Trump campaign sue rogue auditors last year. And then there's the Opportunity Solutions Project, based in Tallahassee, Florida. Its lobbyist at the State House, Andy Conlon of West Des Moines, is registered in favor of the elections bill, as well as measures that would cut unemployment benefits and kick votes off public assistance programs. Why do Floridians want to make it harder to vote or add to the misery of struggling Iowans as a pandemic continues? It can't be that they're jealous of our climate. It's just because that's what the Opportunity Solutions Project does all across the country. It's the lobbying arm of the Foundation for Government Accountability. The CEO of Opportunity Solutions, Taryn Bragdon, is the president and CEO of the FGA, The Operations Director of Opportunity Solutions, Jonathan Bechtel, is COO and General Counsel for FGA. Their biographies note Bragdon's experience cleaning out cow stalls, while Bechtel stocked shelves and broke down bags of flour. Now they're players in a network of conservative think tanks, bill mills, and foundations that craft great ideas for kneecapping the needy. They've been working hard in recent years to convince legislators to add drug tests or work requirements to public assistance programs. They've lobbied to cut food assistance and limit unemployment benefits, even during a pandemic. They've campaigned against ballot initiatives, expanding Medicaid coverage. Last year, they tried and failed to defeat an August referendum in Missouri, expanding Medicaid coverage, arguing able-bodied patients would be stealing money from schools. Sludge, an online investigator reporting site, found in 2019 that FGA had received $2.3 million since 2013 from the Lind and Harry Bradley Foundation, which has donated hundreds of millions of dollars to conservative groups and causes. Among the Bradley Foundation's greatest hits was helping buy billboards in Milwaukee in 2010 and 2012, proclaiming voter fraud is a felony, picturing a black man behind bars. The foundation also funded legal challenges to civil rights protections, including the Voting Rights Act. So these are not folks particularly interested in making voting easier or more equitable. Their playbook is all about fictional fraud, the stuff that built up the big lie, and using it as an excuse to make absentee balloting more difficult and to throw up barriers to public officials or others who might help voters make their voices heard. Our legislators, still spouting nonsense about a stolen election, sided with this shady network or think tanks, dark money nonprofits, and rich guys, while ignoring overwhelming bipartisan opposition to these election changes. No doubt they'll be signed by Governor Kim Reynolds, who FGA recently called, quote, a tireless advocate for Iowa workers and families, end quote. And that's the 24-hour Dorman column. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Thursday, February 25, on IRIS. And now let's turn to the obituaries for today. In the short notices, Rick G. Clinton, from Clinton, and age 62, of Byron, Georgia, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died Saturday, February 20. The Papich Cuba Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids is in charge. In Cedar Rapids, Richard, known as Rich Clamorous, age 75, died Tuesday, February 23, Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service. Also in Cedar Rapids, Doris Nadine Moen, age 96, died Monday, February 22, Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service. In Decorah, Wendy Dotson-Rod Ney, age 53, died Tuesday, February 23. Schluter Ballack Funeral Home, Decorah. In Marion, Lisa Ann Kofod Vogt, age 57, died Tuesday, February 23, Phillips Funeral Home, Vinton. In Monona, Lemoyne Wentz, age 85, died Wednesday, February 24, Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Monona. From Olwine, Marlis O. Brown, age 88, of Sun City West, Arizona, formerly of Ventura, California, and Olwine, died Tuesday, February 23, Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home, Olwine. In St. Lucas, Karen Cruz, age 66, formerly of St. Lucas, died Tuesday, February 16, Schluter Ballack Funeral Home, Decorah. And from West Branch, David Brennicky, David Brennicky, age 82, and Joyce Brennicky, age 85, died Monday, February 22nd, Henderson Barker Funeral Home, West Branch. Moving now to the regular notices, from Cedar Rapids, Robert Lawrence Miller, age 93, passed away peacefully February 20. Visitation was held February 24 at the Gertie Delmore Park Chapel in St. Louis Park. Mass of Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, February 25, at the Church of St. Joseph in St. Paul. Interment at Resurrection Cemetery, Mendota Heights. The Mass will be live streamed at www.churchofstjoseph.org. In Cedar Rapids, Mickey L. Blackwell. Mickey passed away February 23 from complications of T-cell lymphoma at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House with his best friend Cheryl at his side. Mick and Cheryl decided to split their retired years by living in San Juan, Mexico, and where they befriended many, and also in Cedar Rapids. Mick's body was donated to the University of Iowa to be used for cancer research. His body will be cremated. Condolences may be offered at www.iowacremation.com under obituaries or by sending cards to family of Mickey Blackwell, 2525 Townhouse Drive Northeast in Cedar Rapids. Donations may be made in his name to the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of Iowa. A celebration of life will be held from 1 to 3, Saturday, February 27. That will be held at the Knights of Columbus, number 5677, in Cedar Rapids. At 2 p.m., there will be prayers offered. Due to COVID-19, all visitors are asked to wear a mask and remain socially distant. In Cedar Rapids, Landy Gordon Waller III, age 70, of Phoenix, passed away following a short illness on February 4. Home-going services will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, February 27, at Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 Friday, February 26, at the Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, 2121 Bowling Street Southwest. Also in Cedar Rapids, Scott Bauer, age 63, passed away in his home in Cedar Rapids on Tuesday, February 23. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 Friday, February 26th, at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. Also in Cedar Rapids, Patricia Marie Hiles, age 78, went to be with Jesus after a battle with cancer. She passed on Sunday, February 21, at her home, surrounded by family. Services are at 1 p.m. Saturday, February 27th, at the Open Bible Church. Friends may visit with the family starting at noon Saturday before the service at the church. Burial will follow immediately after at Buffalo Cemetery in Hiawatha. In Cedar Rapids, Donna Ruth Miller Wiley, age 93, died February 23 at the Methwick Woodlands. Private graveside services will be held at Spring Grove Cemetery in Covington, officiated by the Reverend John Grieve of Grace Episcopal Church. Arrangements entrusted to Cedar Memorial Westside Chapel. In Martell, Harvey Lee Hickson, age 89, formerly of Martell, passed away February 5 due to natural causes. More information can be found at cedarmemorial.com. In North English, James, known as Pup David Ackerman, formerly of North English, died Tuesday, February 23, at his home in Wayland, at the age of 59. A memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, February 27, at Powell Funeral Home in North English. Burial will be at a later date. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 Friday at the funeral home. The memorial service will be live-streamed on the Powell Funeral Home's Facebook page and website. In Cedar Rapids, Shirley Teresa Jean Maloney Kane, age 85, passed away peacefully at her daughter's home, surrounded by her husband and children, Monday, February 22nd. A private service will be held in interment in Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery at a later date, where she will be buried alongside her grandson, Mitch. Iowa Cremation is in charge of arrangements. From Manchester, Leela Mae Thomas, age 86, passed away Tuesday, February 23, at the Good Neighbor Home in Manchester. Memorials may be directed to Maquoketa Valley Dollars for Scholars. Because of COVID-19, masks are required at the funeral home at the church. Private family funeral service will be held Saturday, February 27, at Earlville United Parish in Earlville, with the Reverend Jill Mack officiating. Public visitation is from 4 to 7 Friday the 26th at Earlville United Parish. Interment at Fairview Cemetery, Earlville. And lastly, from Marion, Arnold Eldon Alcott, age 86, passed away Monday, February 22nd, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. The family will greet friends from 5 to 7 Friday the 26th at the Murdoch Family Home, Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A prayer service will begin at 6:30 at the funeral home. A live stream of the prayer service may be accessed on the funeral home website tribute page for Arnold. Starting at 6:30 p.m. Friday the 26th, the private family interment will take place at Oak Shade Cemetery in Marion at a later date. Moving now to the sports page, on the sideline, high school bowling, Vikings Harrelson wins the Class 1A title. Vinton Sheldsburg Christina Harrelson won the Class 1A state bowling title Wednesday in Waterloo with a score of 478, boosting the Vikings to fourth place in the team race. Louisa Muscatine won the 1A team title. Lamars took home the team crown in Class 2A. Western Dubuque finished third. On the boys' side, Cedar Rapids Xavier finished third as a team behind Clinton and Urbandale in Class 2A. Louisa Muscatine finished first in Class 1A to complete the boys-girls team sweep. And on the front page of the Gazette, best shot for Bears, girls regional basketball finals. This by Jeff Linder for the Gazette. The Bears are back. They're better. And this is their best shot yet to make their state tournament stay an extended one. Third-ranked West Branch led from start to finish, opened the second quarter with a 10-0 run, and closed the third with an 11-0 surge. That was essentially the difference in the 62-39 Class 2A girls basketball regional final contest of Iowa City Regina last night at Williamsburg High School. "We're playing our best basketball right now," senior guard Sasha Koenig said. "We were at our own gym 2 hours before the bus left, getting some shots up. We were ready." West Branch, at 20-1, advances to the state tournament for the fourth time in school history, the second year in a row. It will face number 8 Grundy Center, 19-3, in a 2A quarterfinal at noon next Wednesday at Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines. The Bears' first three state trips, in 1972, 2016, and 2020, were one-and-done propositions. "This team is equipped to hang around a while, maybe all week. We're pretty good," post Delaney Luneka said in an understatement. "We've got so many weapons that are hard to stop. When we get our outside game going, I can get some easy bunnies underneath." It was all humming Wednesday. Four players scored in double figures. Lunekas made it a double-double, and the Bears shot 51%, including 10 of 20 from long range. "We've all been playing together for so long," said Taya Young, who, like fellow starters Koenig, Lexi Peek, and Ryland Drucker, is a senior. "We're comfortable with each other." The Bears weren't so comfortable in the regional finals, squeaking out a 41-37 win over Pella Christian. This was much more stress-free. Leading 17-14 after a quarter, West Branch scored the first 10 for a 13-point advantage, and it was 35-22 at halftime. The second jolt turned a 37-26 margin to 48-26, and the Bears breezed to their third win of the season over the Regals. Also, a girls' basketball regional story by Ryan Plegancool. From Cascade, the defending Class 2A state champs will indeed have an opportunity to defend their title. New look Lynx going back to state. Led by freshman Cameron Kurt, number 5 North Lynn took down number 6 Bellevue, 20-2, 54-36 last night in a regional final action at Cascade High School. Kurt led the Lynx in scoring with 23 points, converting on 5 of 7 three-point attempts. Her performance was particularly impressive, not just because she's a freshman, but also because she's battled through a variety of ailments. "The thing about Cameron is she's hurt," North Lynn head coach Brian Wheatley said. "Her muscles are sore. She's got some ab issues and her back's bothering her, but it doesn't slow her down. She's just a warrior. She came out and had a big game for us tonight." Kurt couldn't take all the credit for last night's win. "It's my teammates," she said. "My teammates work 100% all the time. They want to give me the ball and they work hard to get us extra passes, and that's just what it's all about. After graduating 5 seniors from last year's team, a youthful Lynx team will return to Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines, making its 6th appearance in the state tournament in the last 8 years. It doesn't ever get old, Wheatley said, but honestly, we haven't even talked about defending our title. This is a brand new group of kids. We graduated 5 seniors from last year's team. We have 2 kids that played a lot in the postseason last year. Otherwise, everybody's brand new. While Northland will bring youth to the state tournament, there will also be plenty of firepower. The Lynx entered last night's contest ranking 1st in Class 2A in several offensive categories, including effective field goal percentage, 3-point percentage, 3-pointers per game, field goal percentage, and assists, and the Lynx were firing on all cylinders Wednesday. North Lynn was 7 of 11 from behind the arc in the first half and finished the game 12 of 20. Part of the Lynx's game plan included containing Teresa Paulson, Class 2A's leader in blocks, who averages 4.3 blocks per game. Paulson finished with 12 points but finished well below her average in blocks, tallying just 2. With the win, North Lynn advances to the Class 2A state quarterfinal round in Wells Fargo Arena. They will face Nottoway Valley at 9 p.m. on Tuesday. Our expectations are to go to state and prove people wrong, Kurt said. And in this prep football story by Jeff Johnson, Joyner excited to get started. Marion head coach had been an assistant. Some things will change, some will stay the same. Obviously, Michael Joyner isn't going to divulge specifics on his offensive and defensive philosophies. You'll have to wait until the season begins in the fall to see. Joyner was announced as Marion's new football coach Tuesday, replacing Tim Lovell, who left the Linmar job. A Valley Elgin graduate, he graduated from the University of Iowa and got his master's degree at Morningside. Before coming to Marion, he was a teacher and coach at Glenwood, where he was an assistant football coach, including being offensive coordinator for a playoff team. Joyner grew up in Cedar Rapids, moving with his family after 4th grade. I feel a sense of excitement. I feel a sense of kind of calm because it is so much unknown, he said. Excitement is really the word here, and a sense of opportunity and sense for the administration entrusting me with this position. Really just thankful for the kids and their support. Just really looking forward to getting started. Marion went 3-5 last season, upsetting Clear Creek Amana in a Class 3A postseason game. The Indians' top returnee is sophomore quarterback Alex Mota, who recently received a scholarship offer from Iowa State. We had our first meeting Tuesday morning, and we have about 68 kids in grades 9 through 11 that either showed up to the meeting or were out for football last year and have contacted us saying we couldn't be there but are still interested, Joyner said. That allowed us to kind of meet those kids and kind of get out in front of them already, kind of lay out some of those things that are going to remain kind of similar and some of those things that we may change. Joyner coached freshmen and sophomores at Marion and was part of Lavelle's varsity staff. It was just really good to get in front of those guys and have their support, he said. I could tell that they were relieved a little bit that some of the unknown was gone. They are excited to get to work. A lot of those kids already have been working really hard. Just getting better every day is where we're at right now. Being prepared for June and our off-season stuff when we can actually coach a little bit, then hopefully be ready for the end of August. Moving now to the living page, this story by Allison Gowans for the Gazette, Soul Food on the Go. Vivian Soul Food continues to grow with new Express Grill concept. Jerome and Brianna Smallwood had to cancel a Philly sandwich research trip to Philadelphia due to the pandemic, but that didn't stop them from going ahead with plans to open their latest venture, Vivian's Express Grill, and making Philly's front and center on the menu. For a good Philly, the first thing is the hoagie bread and using real ribeye, Jerome Smallwood said. We wanted to duplicate what you get in Philadelphia, but here in Iowa. Steak, cheese, onions, bell peppers, all on one sandwich. It's a great thing. He went so far as to track down a Philadelphia bread supplier and getting their hoagies to bake his sandwiches as authentic as possible. The couple opened Vivian Soul Food on Cedar Rapids' southwest side in 2017. Since then, community enthusiasm for their food and business has propelled them to first move to a bigger location at 2925 Williams Parkway Southwest, and now to open a spin-off restaurant, Vivian's Express Grill, in the Fountains on the northeast side of town. The new location opened in mid-February. With the new favorite dishes from Vivian's main location and burgers, fillies, po' boys, wraps, and salads, the new concept focuses on quick service food and adding some new fare to the Vivian's repertoire. Soul food is heavy, Jerome Smallwood said. We said, let's do something a little lighter. The goal is for food to be in customers' hands in 12 minutes or less, Brianna Smallwood said. But they still have an emphasis on fresh and made-to-order food, she added. Jerome Smallwood said he always wanted to open a Philly sandwich shop. He initially wanted to name it Iowa House of Phillies, a.k.a. IHOP, but Brianna intervened, afraid they would get sued by using the IHOP moniker. She also thought it was important to keep the Vivian's name that Cedar Rapids diners have come to know. We took the heart with fork and knife logo from Vivian's and used it as the X of Express, she said. It's already branded. It's already recognized. Jerome Smallwood said they've heard from fans who live in the northern part of town that they're glad for a chance to get Vivian's food closer to home. That was part of the reason for choosing the Fountains, as was the continued growth of the business district. Despite challenges of the pandemic making the business environment uncertain, they said they were sure this was the right time to branch out. Business has been up and down. We've had good months and bad months, but we wanted to take this opportunity, Jerome Smallwood said. It's definitely a bit of a gamble that we're taking, but people didn't stop eating because of COVID. The restaurant has a few seats inside, with every other table marked off for social distancing. They weren't partnering with any delivery services when they opened, but were considering adding Grubhub. A carryout-focused, quick-service restaurant was the perfect fit for the moment, he said, and he anticipates the model will remain popular. I see the industry going that way, he said, even with the vaccine. A lot of people still aren't going to be comfortable coming to sit inside a restaurant. The Smallwoods hope this isn't their last expansion, and they hope to open a third location by the end of 2021. Eventually, they'd like to franchise, and Vivian's Express Grill offers an ideal format for that idea, they said. The last few years since first opening Vivian's Soul Food and watching its popularity rise have been somewhat of an emotional roller coaster. Community support, especially during the pandemic, has sustained them and made the long days and hard work feel worth it. It's been a journey, lots of ups and downs, he said. You have your days of, ooh, I'm going to take over the world, and days when you say, what have I gotten myself into? I didn't go into this thinking we'd get the type of response we did, but Cedar Rapids really stood behind us. Brianna Smallwood said when they started the restaurant, they had a mission statement to bring all types of people together over soul food. To be able to create that and see it come to fruition has been very impactful, she said. Ultimately, they're doing this for their children and for the community around them. They want to inspire young people, especially young people of color, to pursue their dreams. We want to create something big and lead by example, she said. If you want to build something, you can make it happen. And if you go, it's Vivian's Express Grill at 5300 Fountains Drive Northeast, number 104 in Cedar Rapids. Their hours are 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday to Saturday, and you can reach them at 319-249-1752 or at viviansoulfoodcr.com. And this story also on the Living page, Chew on This, Community Partners with Restaurants for Annual Fundraisers. Due to the coronavirus pandemic, Community Crisis Services and Food Bank's most popular fundraiser, the annual Pancake Breakfast, will be different. Instead of a pancake breakfast, Community has partnered with local restaurants so that from March 1 to 6, a portion of that restaurant's profits will go to Community. Community is a volunteer-driven nonprofit organization that provides support for those facing emotional, food, or financial crisis in Johnson County. Participating restaurants are Mickey's Irish Pub, the Pizza Ranch on Highway 1 West, and the Pizza Ranch at 395 Beaver Creek Center in North Liberty, Tin Roost in North Liberty, Reunion in Coralville, the Bread Garden in Iowa City, and Hamburg Inn. Midtown Family Restaurants in Iowa City, both at Scott Court and on Highway 1 West, Wildwood, Maggie's Farm Wood-Fired Pizza, and Dumpling Darling. Simply visit a participating restaurant on a specific day, and a portion of your meal's total will go directly to community. For what restaurant is participating when, visit buildcommunity.org/restaurantweek. Our Redeemer Lutheran Church will hold a special collection in place of their annual pancake breakfast, or you can make a financial contribution at buildcommunity.org/pancake-day. Know of any restaurants that are opening or closing? Let us know. Email us features@thegazette.com. That does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on IRIS. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thanks for listening. Have a really great day.